This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading research medical schools. Icon Mount Sinai is the academic arm of the 8-hospital Mount Sinai Health System in New York City. It's consistently among the top recipients of NIH funding. Researchers at Icon Mount Sinai have made breakthrough discoveries in many fields vital to advancing the health of patients, including cancer, COVID and long COVID, cardiology, neuroscience, and artificial intelligence. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. Are you or one of your colleagues doing great neuroscience? If so, then we encourage you to apply for the prestigious Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology, an international prize which honors young scientists for outstanding neurobiological research based on methods of molecular, cellular, systems, or organismic biology. Submissions are due June 15th. Visit science.org/Eppendorf to apply today. This is the Science Podcast for April 5th, 2024. I'm Sarah Crespi. First on the show, did rats come over with Columbus? European colonists were not alone on their ships when they came to the uninfested shores of the Americas. Researcher Eric Guiry joins me to discuss how tiny pieces of bone from early colonial sites and shipwrecks can tell us when these pesky rodents arrived. Next, producer Megan Cantwell talks with contributing correspondent Anne Gibbons about Lucy's Golden Jubilee anniversary. Lucy was a likely human ancestor that lived 2.9 to 3.3 million years ago and was found 50 years ago. They talk about what we've learned about her species and her place in the family tree in those 50 years. The Americas were not only colonized by Europeans, I guess, the middle of the last millennium. Hidden aboard their ships amongst their worldly goods were rats. Black and brown rats both traveled across the Atlantic and established themselves up and down the eastern coast, along with pilgrims and pirates. But despite the omnipresence of their bones at many archaeological sites, when these rats came to the Americas has actually been a little tough to pin down. This Week in Science Advances, Eric Guiry and colleagues trace the ratting of the Americas using bones, isotopes, and a few shipwrecks. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the Science Podcast.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Yeah, this is such an interesting question. I had pet rats, so I'm interested in that. Obviously, they're an important lab animal, but this is more looking at them as an invasive species, how they got to where they are and how they spread. So what made you interested in this question, you know, of their arrival and their spread?
It traces back to an earlier paper we did in 2018, and I think it was Proceedings B. We discovered that rats had very different behaviors based on where they were. So in rural settings, they had quite a different sort of suite of things they were doing compared to urban settings. And this paper was an exploration of those patterns more generally. Ultimately, I was quite interested in sort of animals at the marginalia of archaeology. So thinking about things archaeologists tend to overlook. So I was doing other projects and noticed often in these historic sites, there was a bag just labeled sort of small mammals. And sometimes it hadn't been analyzed, but it was chock full of rat bones. And I kind of noticed this across many sites and thought, there's something here. There's animals that are kind of overlooked and they'll have a story to tell.
So you looked at two types of rats in this paper, the black rat and the brown rat.
That's right.
Which one are we most likely to see these days in the United States?
Actually, that's very complicated. There's not a lot of literature on that. I think you can still see both in many places. So for instance, in Vancouver, near where I am, both are present. Generally speaking, the brown rat is thought to sort of outcompete its smaller cousin, the black rat, across much of its range in temperate areas. But black rats do still show up.
So there's some environmental stuff, like whether or not humans are there, or like all that can affect which rat is present or dominating?
Yes, and it's kind of confusing because there are conditions and places in the world where we know that black rats can sort of dominate. For instance, there are areas in the Southern Hemisphere, for instance, in New Zealand, where the black rats sort of have the upper hand over brown rats. So it's not that one is sort of inherently going to always outcompete the other. There are lots of factors at play. And we actually don't understand those terribly well, considering that both species can do similar things. So, well, they might have sort of different tendencies, like black rats are more sort of arboreal and brown rats are more sort of fossorial, maybe living in the ground. They can actually do the same range of things. So their ecologies can overlap fairly completely.
Mm-hmm. And so in this paper, you looked deep into the past of their presence here on this continent, and you wanted to know when they got here and then how they vied for power over time. It sounds like rat wars, but you know what I mean.
Yep.
In your method, you mostly worked with rat bones, as we discussed, from various sites up and down the eastern coast. How did you pick these sites? I was a little bit sad that I didn't see Philadelphia in here. How did you decide where to specifically look at the rat bones from early colonial days?
To some extent, I picked places that I'd heard or read had rat bones. So As I mentioned, these bones kind of often end up in auxiliary bags in these faunal assemblage collections. So it's not always easy to find them. They're not always featured in the publications where people write up about the animal bones they found at archaeological sites. So some of it was sort of hearsay. Somebody, you know, I'd met would say, oh, this site's chock full of rat bones. Why don't you look there? And that might lead to somebody else who says, oh, that one's full of them too. So to some extent, it was just being able to locate them, which is sort of directing where it was. That said, I'm fairly certain that rat bones will be a presence in most historical archaeological assemblages that sort of have had the excavation techniques that can actually recover them. So you need to do sieving, you need to pay closer attention to the excavation in a way that would recover the small bones.
If you go back in time far enough, some of these archaeological sites are not going to have rat bones because rats weren't here yet. Do we know when the first, I guess it was black rats got here first? Do we know when they first came?
Supposedly they were on Columbus's first voyage. So 1492.
Oh gosh. Just so specific. Amazing.
Yeah. It's one of those times where you can really tell, like, okay, yeah, that was the sort of advent of this whole giant process that followed of sort of rats colonizing the Americas. It's pretty clear when black rats arrived, but brown rats, it's not at all clear. There are a lot of stories in the literature that get retold and rehashed. They're not well-founded, and it's not clear when they arrived in Europe either. It's generally thought in North America, for instance, that it was around the time of the American independence, so circa 1775. But we can be fairly sure, based on the results of this study, that they were here earlier.
How can you tell from the bones from these sites that it's a black rat or a brown rat?
So the morphology and shape of the bones can differ between the two species, but those are difficult to tell. If you have like a complete skull, then you can more easily establish which it is. But often archaeologically, we're just finding small fragments. So we used a peptide fingerprinting technique that can allow you to differentiate the two. It's based on tiny differences between the sequence of amino acids that are present in the collagen of the two species. So slight differences allow you to differentiate them.
So you could tell which ones are which, and you tried to tell the age of them with a couple of different methods. Turns out that radiocarbon is not going to do a great job for this time period. And so you went to archaeology, but there are also some bumps on that road.
Yeah, it's very difficult. We weren't really able to sort of date things in a radiocarbon sense. We were relying on archaeological context information. And because brown rats can burrow, you know, when we find them in early contexts, it's always a bit of a question mark going, well, could they have just gotten there on their own? Were they intrusive and not actually reflecting the date of that deposit? So one of the ways we got around this was to look at rats in shipwrecks.
Oh, this is great. Yeah.
Yeah. We know when that ship was built. We know when it sank. We often even know where it's been. And rats are unlikely to be sort of swimming down into shipwreck sites and burrowing in and dying there for us to find later. So it's a pretty ironclad way of looking at chronology. So some of those shipwreck dates were, well, one of them in particular was really useful in giving us a super firm date, latest possible date of arrival for the brown rats, which was about 1760.
A little bit before Declaration of Independence, but still in that 1700s, mid-1700s, a rat being on a ship, is it leaving this continent? Is that why you know it's from here as opposed to coming from somewhere else?
I think we could be fairly sure that when rats are on ships that are going to ports, that they're going to get out. It's quite clear from some of the earliest literature, you know, the letters back from colonists in different places, some of the first things they ask for is like rat's bane or various things that can help them deal with their sort of rat.
Oh my goodness.
The rat infestation. So because we find it in a ship doesn't 100% mean that it was also in the port that ship had gone to, but it's fairly likely. But we're being super conservative with that perspective. We do have archaeological contexts that seem fairly secure that date well before that, as early as, say, 1720 to 1740. We had a context in New Orleans with a brown rat. So we take those a little bit more cautiously, but there are enough of them that a pattern starts to emerge where it's fairly clear they were there before 1760. So through some modeling, we were able to suggest tentative early arrival of, say, 1730s. So while that's tentative, I would suspect that, you know, if we were to expand these analyses considerably, we would find earlier evidence.
They just go where people go, it sounds like.
Absolutely, yeah.
You talked a little bit about how as soon as colonists got here, there were rats here and they were like, oh, these rats, we have to do something about them. Is there anything we can learn from your results here or your earlier study for today's rats?
Black rats and brown rats do seem to have an affinity or a preference for higher animal protein diets. So that makes sort of a preferred habitat for them is likely access to these kinds of foods. So to the extent that it's possible to control that access and to limit it, you'd be sort of limiting the availability of preferable habitat for them.
I lived in Washington, D.C. for a long time. I saw plenty of rats. I saw them on the train tracks. I saw them outside, you know, on patios, at restaurants. They're kind of all around us, but it's still kind of difficult to study them.
I'm not a contemporary ecologist studying urban environments, but I understand from the literature that it is quite a challenge to study rats in current urban places. And that has to do with sort of jurisdiction and accessing all the places that a rat might go. A rat doesn't care that it's leaving your study area or moving amongst different areas. It's actually quite challenging, costly, and sort of time-consuming to do research in these areas on rats.
Part of it is because it's a populated area, you have to go into all these spaces that are limited against people coming in, but rats have managed to finagle their way in there.
That's right. Rats aren't like wandering around, you know, to be seen. They're doing their own thing, and that often involves places that sort of the margins of society. It's kind of difficult to observe them. And one of the interesting things about archaeology, and what I think we could think a lot more about in terms of archaeological fauna remains, is that we have this massive trove of animals that represent human-animal relationships over hundreds or even thousands of years, depending on where you are. And those human-animal relationships could tell us a lot about how we might relate to animals in the future, particularly in the context of sort of urban planning.
You mentioned you're in Vancouver, you're on the West Coast. You have rats there, I'm sure. Are those rats descendants from the early colonial rats, or are they their own thing?
One of the interesting things, there was something called the Manila trade starting in the mid 16th century, so the 1560s, where it was a direct trade route between the Philippines and the west coast of North America. So they could have come directly across the Pacific as well. Our study wasn't able to sort of look at that. You need to do genetic work and a lot more sampling in that region, but it's quite possible that there's a much more complex picture at play here.
So it might not be the case that they came to the eastern coast and then traveled across the continent and started colonizing the west coast. They had their own separate delivery of rats over there on the west side.
It's possible.
Yeah.
It's equally like possible that they came across once the railways were through, or they traveled with the 49ers or whoever else was moving up and down the coast with ships infested with rats.
Yeah. What else do you want to learn about early rat populations in the United States, or, you know, what are you going to study next?
Well, right now I'm actually part of a UKRI-funded project based out of the University of York in the UK, and we're looking at the spread of rats in Europe. To some extent, we'll include some information from the state. So we're going to do some genetic studies to look at relationships between different rat communities in those early years. So that's something that we'll be moving along hopefully soon.
That sounds amazing. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Eric Geary is a research associate in the Trent Environmental Archaeology Lab at Trent University. You can find a link to the Science Advances article we discussed at science.org/podcast. Stay tuned for a chat about Lucy at 50 with producer Megan Cantwell and contributing correspondent Anne Gibbons.
After paleoanthropologist Don Johansson defended his graduate thesis, a member of his committee asked him what he was going to do now that he graduated. He told him, "I'm going to Africa, and I'm going to find something really good." That same year, on a hot day in November of 1974, Johansson glanced over his right shoulder and saw a fossil, specifically the part of the elbow that lets you flex and extend your arm. Over the next 2 weeks, researchers uncovered more and more pieces to a skeleton that all belonged to one specimen, who they named Lucy, after the Beatles song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. For the 50th anniversary of Lucy's discovery, contributing correspondent Ann Gibbons took a look at her legacy and how much our understanding of the human family tree has changed since then. Thank you so much for joining me, Ann.
Happy to be here.
Could you set the scene for what exactly we knew about our ancestors before we discovered Lucy?
So before we discovered Lucy, there had been fossils discovered in East Africa in the 1950s and 60s that showed us that members of our genus, Homo, showed up around 2 million years ago or so. And it had been a long time coming because Darwin had predicted back in the 1870s that members of the human family arose in Africa rather than in Asia. But fossils weren't discovered until the 1920s in South Africa that showed that Africa was probably the place where human ancestors arose. And there was still a great deal of debate about that until the 1950s. The big question is, what came earlier before 2 million years ago? And so when Lucy was found at 3.1 million, the feeling at the time was that if you reached back a little bit further, you would get an ancestor we shared with chimpanzees.
What about her discovery stood out? How was she different than the previous finds they had had in other areas of Africa?
So Lucy was interesting because she showed that upright walking came before a big brain. Her brain is only a little bit larger than the size of an ape's. What was most exciting is her partial skeleton. We have 40% of her skeleton showed that she walked upright. It's very clear. We had known from earlier fossils from South Africa that upright walking probably came before the big brain, but Lucy confirmed that. Before that, researchers had thought maybe that upright walking and the big brain and tool use all came together.
It seemed like it was kind of a curveball discovering Lucy first, since she was so tiny, she was only 3 feet tall. And that made researchers think, oh, all these early humans were probably tiny little things. But then as they discovered more of her species, Australopithecus afarensis, they found out, oh, no, there's actually a lot of diversity. Is that diversity in her species unique when you compare it to other early humans that have been found?
No, it's not unique. But what we have from A. afarensis, which is her species, is a remarkable number of well-preserved individuals. In addition to Lucy, we have the first family, a whole group of individuals that died suddenly that include children, males, and then other individuals found not only at Hadar, but afarensis has been found in Tanzania. A number of members have been found fossils throughout Africa, East Africa, including Kenya, possibly in Cameroon. Her species lasted for a very long time, maybe as early as 3.8 to 3.85 million. That's a little bit debatable. All the way down to 2.9 million years. Interestingly, by having so many individuals, we also learned that the males are quite a bit bigger than the females. Now, Lucy's still a small female. She's unusually small, but the males were quite a bit larger, which suggests they were competing quite fiercely for female mates. We can also see, for example, how afarensis adapted to different habitats over time.
It was quite a while, right, that Lucy kind of sat, had the crown as the oldest ancestor of ours, but she's been dethroned in recent years. You actually joined a lot of these people on their expeditions in the 90s to try to find these older specimens. There were multiple research groups that were competing to try to find something older. What ended up coming of those expeditions?
Yes. So the big, big question after the discovery of Lucy and members of her species is what came before her? Well, lo and behold, the big surprise was no, she wasn't that primitive. That if she was at 3.2 million, there was 2 to 3 million years of human evolution before her. One of the first discoveries was a fossil called Australopithecus anamensis. That dates to about 4.2 million years in East Africa. The wonderful thing about Australopithecus anamensis is that she looks like a more primitive version of Lucy in many ways. That pushes back Australopithecus to about 4.2 million. But then several teams, including two teams that bet each other, Tim White of Berkeley and Michel Brunet, a Frenchman, they would find the earliest member of the human family. Tim White's team found this fossil, Ardipithecus ramidus, that dates to 4.4 million years, a partial skeleton that is what they call the root ape. It's much more primitive than anamensis and afarensis. It was still spending a lot of time in the trees. but not walking upright like a modern human. And this thing would look more like an ape than a modern human if you saw it. Tim likes to say you wouldn't invite Ardipithecus ramidus to dinner. Then, in addition to finding Ardipithecus ramidus, Johannes Haile Selassie found something that was 5.8 million years old called Ardipithecus cadaba. It's an earlier ancestor of Ardipithecus ramida. And then the biggest and oldest, probably more controversial fossil was Michel Brunet found a beautiful skull in the Jurab Desert of Chad, dating between 6 and 7 million years, that is of an ancient member of the human family that Michel Brunet claims walked upright based on the angle at which the skull sat atop the spine. It shows several traits that suggest it was also walking upright, would make it a hominin rather than ancestor of another ape. We'd love to find more fossils to prove that.
With all these discoveries of earlier human ancestors, how did that change our understanding of how the traits that define us as humans evolved over time, like upright walking, brain size?
Yes. So first of all, it doubles the time back of the human family from Lucy's age of 3.2 to 6 to 7 million. Probably one of the very first things that started us down the road toward the path of becoming human rather than another kind of ape was upright walking. Then we begin to see some changes in the teeth, which show perhaps a little less aggression, maybe less competition for mates. Maybe because we're upright walking, the males are helping females get food, because if they're carrying a baby and walking upright, it's hard to gather as much food as you would need. So maybe we're seeing some social changes that start to make us more human-like, more cooperation. Then later, after Lucy, we begin to see tool use. That has now been pushed back to probably 3.3 million years ago. There's nothing that says that Lucy wasn't capable of making primitive tools, but no one has ever found stone tools at the sites where Lucy's species are found. Tool use, and then later the big brain starts to take off around 1.8 to 1.6 million years ago. And at that point, we're fully in the carnivore guild, hunting and competing with carnivores for meat.
We talked about how Lucy's been dethroned as our oldest ancestor, but there's also a lot of other species that probably shared the same landscape with her during her time. What other species might have existed and how might they have interacted with Afarensis?
Yeah, so what's really exciting is that when Lucy was found, she was the queen of all the hominins. Lucy was seen as the direct ancestor of our genus Homo and also of Australopithecus africanus, which is in South Africa, and also perhaps of this other more robust genus of hominins, a whole group called Paranthropus. But then starting in the 90s, researchers began to find some other fossils that were around at the same time as Lucy. The first one was Kenyanthropus platyops, which showed up at about 3.5 million years ago, perhaps persisting to 3.3 million years. Then only 30 kilometers away from Hadar, Johannes Haile Selassie found another species called A. Dariameda, which dates from about 3.3 to 3.5 million years as well. And it's found at a site where Lucy's species is also found at roughly the same time. And A. anamensis shows up there also at about the same time. You have those three specimens, and then a foot. It's a very primitive foot that looks a little bit more like an earlier hominin. So you have four species all around at about the same time, between 3.3 and 3.5 million years ago. Are any of those ancestors of early Homo? Nobody is as good a contender as Lucy at this point. She's still the best fossil that's most like early Homo to be the ancestor of our lineage. But the fact that there are other kinds of hominins around that we found suggests that we're only seeing part of what was there. So it's not this neat, simple story of just Lucy giving rise to early Homo in a straight, neat lineage. It's a more complicated picture now.
We've touched on the major discoveries that have been made since Lucy was discovered in 1974. And there hasn't been much progress necessarily in hunting for these fossils, right? It's just still kind of mainly the same technique to look for these.
Well, I think the way people look is very similar, although they use satellite imagery more now to look for areas of erosion, which help them zero in on where to go, look for fossils. But I would say the biggest change has been the number of specialists that come to a site now and try to reconstruct what the ancient landscape was like, what was the ancient weather, what kind of ancient plants were there, what was the habitat that Lucy was living in? How did that change over time? What did she eat? Also, how do you date the sites? The dating revolution has really gotten precise. We can fingerprint actual specific volcanic eruptions and get much more precise dates and tie different sites across the landscape together. So we know a whole lot more about the world that Lucy lived in. That has been reconstructed now. every fossil site, researchers are able to do this to reconstruct the ancient worlds. It's not enough anymore just to discover the fossils. You've got to put the hominins in the context. What was their habitat? And how do they adapt to it? How did their habitat change over time? When Lucy first emerges, she's living in a more wooded landscape. By the end, she's living in a much more varied, dry habitat. So she's adapted. She's more flexible than most other hominins that we've seen before her. She's able to range across different landscapes and survive, which is a hallmark of being a member of our genus Homo, that we are able to adapt to a lot of different habitats.
In terms of other advancements within the field, what would you say stand out to you besides understanding the paleo environment?
We also are really good at analyzing the fossils now. The 3D morphometrics revolution has meant that we can really compare with statistical confidence different jaws, different teeth, different skulls, different bones, and see how they really vary. Also, genetics have come in. We are now studying ancient DNA, not back to Lucy's time. We can't get DNA that old, but it has revolutionized the way we study members of our species, early Homo sapiens, and our encounters with Neanderthals and other species that we interbred with. There's a revolution going on underway in studying ancient proteins, and those are going back in time to studying fossils that are as early as almost, 500,000 years and earlier. So we're beginning to use ancient proteins to differentiate fossils to see if they belonged to different species and maybe even to get at things like their diet and how they lived on the landscape, ancient diseases. That hasn't happened yet, but we're beginning to get there.
The reason we're putting out this story now instead of in November when Lucy was actually discovered is because there's a big celebration of Lucy's legacy and recent research that is happening at the Institute of Human Origins this week. And you're attending and also speaking at that celebration. What do you think will come of the discussions from there? What kind of new research is on the cutting edge right now?
So there will be talks about the fossils and the new fossils. Johannes Haile Selassie will talk about the diversity and the new fossils that have been discovered. Other people are going to talk about the kind of animals that lived with her and the changes in understanding of her habitat. Now there are as many as 50 PhDs working on some of these sites with different specialties. And so there are projects drilling the ancient lake sediments to try to reconstruct how climate changed and the conditions over time in which hominins developed. And can we say things like, how changes in the climate, did that drive speciation? Did it drive new bursts of new species? Because suddenly in dire times, different hominins had to adapt. Also, I'm hoping we'll hear a little bit more about the animal herself. It's interesting to find out, how did she live? What was she like? Not only what did she look like, but what was she doing on the landscape? And how does that reveal why members of the human family survived? How we became human and what came after her?
An anniversary like this is also a good time to reflect, look forward to how things might work in the future. And Johannes Haile Selassie, an Ethiopian paleoanthropologist who you mentioned before, has found a lot of amazing fossils. He's helping to lead a workshop on how to build up the infrastructure in African countries to support local scholars to contribute to this important work. In the past few decades, how have more Ethiopians and Kenyans become involved in this research that initially was really led by mostly white people?
Yeah, so when I first started covering this in the early 90s, that was the beginning of training Africans like Johannes Haile Selassie. Some of those paleoanthropologists like Johannes Haile Selassie, Zeresanai Alemseged, are now leading major expeditions that have found major fossils in East Africa, the same in Kenya, Chelamonte, and in South Africa. But very few of them get to actually work in Africa because there isn't still the infrastructure other than at the museums where researchers can get the kind of funding to do the research and be based in East Africa. There's a lot of work going on. These paleoanthropologists that are African that work in East Africa have formed an organization where they encourage the training and development and sharing of scientific results, but a lot more needs to be done there. So Lucy's, I think, helped open that up, as did other fossils found in Kenya. Her legacy, though, if it leads to training more Africans, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Anne, for joining me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Anne Gibbons is a contributing correspondent for Science. You can find a link to her story at science.org/podcasts.
And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. To find us on podcasting apps, search for Science Magazine. Don't forget, Google's podcasting app is going away, so make sure you subscribe somewhere else. Or you can listen on our website, science.org/podcast. The show was edited by me, Sarah Crespi, and Kevin McLean, with production help from Megan Tuck at Podigy. Special thanks to Megan Cantwell for making a podcast segment while she was making a video about Lucy's 50th. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us. You listen to us to hear about new discoveries in science, but did you know we're a part of the American Association for the Advancement of Science? AAAS is a nonprofit publisher and a science society. When you join AAAS, you help support our mission to advance science for the benefit of all. Become a AAAS member at the silver level or above to receive a year's subscription to Science and an exclusive gift. Join today by visiting AAAS.org/join. That's AAAS.org/join.